Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, August 30th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free at whyagain.org. If you go to that page and click on the Start Here logo in the upper left-hand corner, it'll take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. There are a host of tools, but the primary tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships and to turn any negative emotional state that I experience into part of the infallible guidance system that each of us has been gifted. You can also download a host of audio files of shows just like this one, where people have been stepped through that process. You can also click a link and download the PDF of the most recent version of that process, absolutely free. Print it off, copy it, use it as often as you'd like. And then if you choose to download and listen to those audio files, they can serve as a tutorial for how to get the best results from applying this tool persistently and consistently in your life. And you can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness, and before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. And when you click on that link, it'll let you have access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. So we hope you do that soon and often, and then give us a call at 563-999-3581 and press 1. Or alternatively, you can send us an email. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, or you can email Jeannie Rice at jeannie@whyagain.org, whyagain.org. So we have been following through on the commitment to listen to read the Course in Miracles workbook lessons this year. And today is the 242nd day of the year. And the lesson simply reads, this day is God's day. It is my gift to him. Commentary says, I will not lead my life alone today. I do not understand the world. And so try to lead my life alone must be but foolishness. But there is one who knows all that is best for me, and he is glad to make no choices for me but the ones that lead to the Creator. I give this day to him, for I would not delay in my coming home. And it is he who knows the way to the Creator. And so we give today to you. We come with wholly open minds. We do not ask for anything that we may think we want. Give us what you would have us receive. You know all our desires and all our wants, and you will give us everything we need in helping us to find our way to you. That's the message to the Creator. And Pam Grout, with her Course in Miracles experiment book, titles Lesson 242, Priorities. She quotes Rob Brzezinski as saying, I will never again cast a curse on myself. Pam writes, it's time to get out and celebrate. Time to remember how lucky you are. Time to give praise to the highest of holies. As Rob Brzezinski likes to say, let's break open the forbidden happiness. Sure, I have a to-do list. In fact, I have two of them. On mine, the to-do list says, dream up better questions and have the best day of my life. The other to-do list is for Source, God, the field of potentiality. Here's what it says. Handle everything else. So I just focus on dreaming up better questions and how to have the best day of my life, and creation unfolds in a way that handles everything else. As I think about this lesson and I think about the Course in Miracles experiment with Pam Grout today, it reminds me of how so many places in The Way of Mastery, it talks about how we don't know what anything is or is for. This is the very, very same message that comes across in Course in Miracles. We don't know what anything is. We don't know what anything is for. There's even an exercise in one of the lessons that says, spend some time, take about 15 minutes out of your day, and just look around and pick up something. Pick up a paperweight, pick up a mug, pick up a book that you have, pick up a clock on your table, and just sit with it and let yourself understand that you do not know where this came from. You do not know who had the first idea for a clock. You don't know where the material came from to construct this clock, if it's plastic, if it's metal. You don't know how many different human beings were responsible for getting this clock from the idea in someone's head into material form and then into your possession. And when we begin to work with that exercise and we let ourselves sit with the truth that most of what we create as what we know is just made up thoughts, is fantasy, is a construct of thoughts designed to give us some sense of feeling solid and in control. And the truth of our lives is that there's so much more going on around us than we can keep track of, that the path to happiness does not come through the conscious logical mind. We open up a world of possibility, and we open up the possibility to be taught infinitely when we cancel our need to be right and we open ourselves to the recognition that we don't know what anything is or is for. So That's our Course in Miracles workbook lesson for today and the Course in Miracles experiment. And I was thinking about putting on what I would consider as a treat for this listening audience, and that is the interview I did with Robert Whittaker. And it's only about 40 minutes long, so I thought I would do a little intro and then open it up to see if anybody had any quick questions. And when there's about 40 minutes left, run the Robert Whittaker interview. So that's on the record for Mindshifter Radio and can get some more people access to that that person who is, I believe, a phenomenal mind, and some of his thoughts from two of his five books. The first one that I read was Anatomy of an Epidemic, and the next one was Mad in America. And Mad in America traces the history of treating mental health in America from the 1700s until today. And the The Anatomy of an Epidemic talks about how clearly there's a problem with all of the medications that are being prescribed for psychiatric and psychological issues and symptoms. And the problem is, if these medications were really as good as they say they are, wouldn't you think that our incidents of people needing to be hospitalized and repeat hospitalizations and eventually filing for mental health disability, wouldn't you think that would be going down over the years if these medications were actually useful in treating these conditions or symptom patterns? Well, that's the conclusion I would have. If something works, then, you know, it's going to reduce the incidence. But the fact of the matter is, the rate of people, the number of people, and the rate at which people are filing for mental health disability has gone up decade after decade since the, quote, discovery of these cures or medications or treatments, whatever you want to call them. And so I have a conversation with Mr. Robert Whittaker, and I will start that in a bit. But first I'll see if anybody has a comment or a question. We've got about 7 minutes before I start that interview. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. What's on your mind? What would you like to highlight as a topic for later in the week, since we're here 5 days a week, 2 hours a day? I'm going to take a chance and turn on the microphone for Susan. Are you available to speak?
Hi, I have my mouth full of a sandwich, but yes. Can you hear me?
Well, I can hear you.
Okay, good.
Did you hear that I was going to play this
Right.
I appreciate the email you sent me. I think too many cooks spoil the broth is the first thought I have about your speaking engagement. I was very excited that you were going to be doing that solo, because you can do a fabulous job all by yourself. Now that you've expanded it to include Michael and Jeannie, I think that's more than enough. And the other one that you sent me, I would just, my response was this lovely prayer keeps hitting the wrong chord for me, because it's such an anthropomorphized view of the Creator. But it's a lovely set of thoughts. I think that the same essence comes out, and it's more flexible when I just say, I don't know. And it's okay that I don't know, because the flow of life and creation is going to keep going. And all kinds of unknown forces have been at play to help me get from, you know, the inception of my soul or body to where I am today. And I don't need to know. So I can sit back and relax, and I don't have to fantasize that there is a larger psychological entity out there, like my great grandfather, or, you know, the male god with the white hair sitting in a cloud directing things, but that life is always going to unfold in ways I could never imagine, and I can just go along for the ride and appreciate it. The way
I
might,
that a lot.
The way I might watch a symphony or a play or a football game, I have no idea how it's going to end, and it's going to be okay.
I'll have to read it again in light of what you said, but I'm sure I'm interested in your take. That's good. Thanks. And as for those speaking things, I talked to Dr. Ryman this morning, and she said, you know, these talks are peer-to-peer users of tools. She wants to get to know you and Michael and Jeannie, but she thought about it, and she said it would really be better if you, as a user of the tools, presented the tool yourself, and we'll get Michael and Tim on it in some other way later on when the intention of the talks is different than what it is. So I'm calling everybody off too. Too many cooks, maybe that's a way of looking at it, but I told her, Michael particularly being the creator of the tool, I mean, you can't really, I would feel a little awkward presenting it when he's right there, and so I figured he would present it, and then I'm thinking, but maybe for this, that's not the right thing. So anyway, I'm composing a letter to all of you to say, hey, the deal's off, I'm on my own here, and maybe later with something else.
Three cheers for Susan. I think that's probably more in the spirit of the person who's creating the program, and it's great, because then you're going to do a wonderful job, and then you're going to have more confidence when you go to present in different ways, whether it's individually to people or on programs like that. And and it might be better for this woman, because then she can, you know, choose to have Michael on at a later date. And then there's more, you know, people who do that kind of thing are most often looking for good content.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be better for her to have another source of good content rather than load up all those people on the same show.
Yeah, I agree. That's true. So,
yes?
Yes. Thanks.
You said,
yeah,
so,
I think I
okay.
can do it. Yeah, I would
You'll
like
do a
to,
fabulous job.
Thank you. I would like to go over the five-step pattern of sheet sometime. If you think, I mean, the latest one I sent you is the latest iteration. I had changed a couple of words, and I want to make sure they're all right. So.
Yeah, and I would be happy to do that. I think we should do that just for our own use. I think that's a wonderful refinement on that work. And so let's set a time to do that, and I'll email you about that.
Okay, great.
And for now, I will put you on mute, and I will read an intro and then start the interview I did with Robert Whitaker. Robert is the author of 4 books and co-author of a 5th. 3 of these books tell of the history of psychiatry. One of them is Anatomy of an Epidemic. The other one is Mad in America. But his Anatomy of an Epidemic won the U.S. Investigative Reporters and Editors Book Award for Best Investigative Journalism. And prior to writing books, he worked as a science reporter at the Albany Times Union newspaper in New York for a number of years. He's also the founder of MadInAmerica.com. It's a website that features research, news, and blogs by an international group of writers who are interested in rethinking psychiatry. And he was kind enough to let me do an interview, and it is as follows.
Well, so Robert, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
I was hoping you could start us off by telling us how you got into this work and what drives your passion for it.
Sure. Try to keep that story short. So my background, I worked for newspapers for a long time covering science and medicine. And in 1998, I was doing a series for the Boston Globe, really just looking at abuses of patients in psychiatric research settings. And at this time, I had a completely conventional understanding of psychiatry. My understanding was that researchers had discovered that depression and, quote, schizophrenia are caused by chemical imbalances, and we had drugs that fix those chemical imbalances, which, of course, is a story of great progress. And that's what I had written about as a newspaper reporter. But while doing that series, I came upon 2 studies that belied that notion of progress. One were studies by the World Health Organization, which twice compared outcomes for schizophrenia patients in 3 developing countries, India, Colombia, and Nigeria, with outcomes in the U.S. and other developed countries. And each time they found that outcomes were much better in the developing countries, specifically India and Nigeria. And I dug into that a little bit because that seemed surprising. The story that we had organized around was a story of great medical advance, and then somehow it wasn't coming out in the outcomes.
Yeah, we've got the miracle cure. How could
exactly.
they get better
I
results?
I mean, that's what the chemical imbalance story is. It's a story of like a miracle cure. And I can't tell you how many times I called up psychiatrists and they told me, oh, yeah, schizophrenia is due to too much dopamine. The drugs block it. It brings it back into balance. That's what I was told regularly. Anyway, in the second study, the World Health Organization investigators hypothesized maybe the reason for the better outcomes in the poor countries is they're more medication compliant. They take their antipsychotics regularly. They adhere to that treatment. Now, that's a valid hypothesis because if medications are so essential, which certainly we believe in this country related to schizophrenia and psychotic disorders, then adherence should lead to better outcomes. But what they found was that in the developing countries with the best outcomes, they use the drugs acutely but not chronically. They only maintained about 11% of their patients regularly on the medications. Now, this sort of blew my mind because literally in this series, by the way, which I was rewarded for for the Boston Globe, one of the frameworks was you should never take away antipsychotics from schizophrenic people because it's like insulin for diabetes. But this made me wonder, have I got something wrong here? And then I found a study by Harvard researchers that looked at evolving schizophrenia outcomes over the past century. Now, again, part of the narrative of the progress is that in 1955, we get Thorazine, chlorpromazine. It's introduced into asylum medicine, and that makes this great advance forward. And you can even read histories of psychiatry where they compare the introduction of Thorazine as similar in importance as the introduction of antibiotics in infectious medicine. And that's telling you of a great advance. But what did the Harvard researchers find? They found that schizophrenia outcomes, in fact, were in decline in the United States, and they were now no better, and in other developing countries, and they were now no better than they had been in the first third of the 20th century, long before the arrival of the antipsychotics. So both of these studies belied what I knew to be true. And that led me to get a contract to write a book called Mad in America. And basically, the purpose of this book was to investigate why are outcomes for, quote, the mad or people with schizophrenia so poor in the United States. And what I found in the course of that investigation is we have this narrative of progress around antipsychotics and psychiatric drugs is they fix chemical imbalances. But you find that that's not true. You find that it was a hypothesis born of understanding how drugs acted on the brain, and then they hypothesized the drugs had the opposite effect. But they actually never found that a lesion in the dopamine sections of the brain is a primary cause of schizophrenia. Then you take that same, you know, look through the scientific literature with antidepressants, and you find the same story. Antidepressants are said to depression is said to be caused by low serotonin. The drugs up serotonin, they fix it like insulin for diabetes. Well, what you find in the scientific literature is that hypothesis was born in the 1960s based on what the first antidepressants did. They investigated in the 70s and 80s, and as early as 1984, the NIMH was saying, we're just not finding a lesion in the serotonin system. In 1998, the American Psychiatric Association's own textbook said, this hypothesis hasn't panned out, and frankly, it wasn't a very smart hypothesis because there's no reason that the pathology of a disorder should be the opposite of some drug that treats symptoms.
Right.
So literally what happened was, A, I thought, as I investigated this, we, American society and other developed societies, are organizing their thinking and their care around a false narrative with the chemical imbalance narrative at the core of that. And then once you start digging into the narrative, the second part that you find over and over again is that while psychiatric medications, say antipsychotics or antidepressants, may provide some benefit over placebo in knocking down symptoms over the short term, you see in both lines of research on schizophrenia and depression that worries develop pretty early on that the use of these medications is actually increasing the chronicity of these disorders, the relapse rates and functional impairments over the long term. And once I began, and that, I really explored that in the book you mentioned, Anatomy of an Epidemic, and think about this. Mental health and thinking about ourselves is such a critical part of our lives and a critical part of how a society responds to problems, how it treats its kids, how you think of yourself. And writ large, what I found, and I had been a science and medical reporter for a long time, and for example, I was the director of communications at Harvard Medical School for a long time. Not a long time, but for a period of time. So I had a very solid sort of scientific training. And we have a situation here where we as a society have organized ourselves around what I call a false narrative of science, and it is doing great harm. You can see the harm in the rising burden of mental illness among our kids, among our adults. We have early death problems, more people on disability. So that's the reason I got into this, and that's the reason for my passion, because I think this storytelling of a false narrative has had a great impact on our lives and a negative impact. And to have good science and good treatment, you have to organize your thinking around whatever science is telling you and what people with lived experience are telling you too. They need to be heard from as well.
Well, and that's one of the things that struck me in your book when you were talking about how our societal narrative has really been the driving force for what we tolerate and allow. And as you are talking about treating the, quote, mad, the people who are mad from the 1700s forward, as the narrative changes, the money that's available for the treatment facilities, the nature of treatment facilities that are made available is changing as well. And, you know, I was shocked by the information you have about eugenics and how powerful that was here in the United States before that misguided concept was adopted by the Germans and the concentration camps. But it's the same thing. We had abandoned people who had mental health issues and chosen to view them as a burden on society or on high society, and then the money dried up. And
they literally would call people with, you know, in mental hospitals, psychiatric disorders, or just sometimes just odd people were put in hospitals, a burden on the population.
Exactly.
And those were the words they used. And they were, and really what under the eugenics ideas that took hold around the turn of the century, around 1900, well, of course, we got forced sterilization. But we also got the sense they need to be segregated in mental hospitals so they don't spread their bad genes. So what you see is discharge rates for first episode, quote, psychotic patients prior to the eugenics era weren't bad. Like you'd see 65-70% being discharged. But once you get eugenic ideas, the idea is to keep them there at least through the breeding years. And discharge rates go down and we start saying, oh, this is why these disorders are chronic. But that actually was the policy. And by the way, as you say, we were the first country to adopt eugenic ideas into legislative policies. From 1945 to 55, after eugenics became a discredited idea, look at discharge rates in America's mental hospitals for that decade. After you leave this idea we should segregate them, discharge rates for first episode psychotics are 65-70%. We forget that because the part of the narrative is they couldn't come out until the antipsychotics arrived in 1955. That's just not true. Discharge rates for first episode patients were already 65-70% before the antipsychotics.
And it's clear, your work and others have pointed out, that when you put people on medications, it dramatically increases the probability that they'll have numerous relapses or be chronic or need to be on those medications forever because they create physiological change patterns in the brain as the brain is trying to reach its homeostasis. And what most of the studies that talk about withdrawal or taking people off medication, they just drop them off cold turkey or very quickly, and then they get a rebound effect and say, well, look, that means they need to be on this to prevent psychosis. Whereas people like Dr. Bregan and others point out, that's ridiculous. If you come off slowly, if you come off with the aid of some other things, if you haven't been on it too long, you don't have the chronic relapse and rebound and psychotic episodes.
There's two things on this. I mean, this actually shows up shortly after the introduction of antipsychotics in the 1950s. All of a sudden, clinicians who had been used to discharge rates and people staying well rates, they noticed people were coming back more frequently now. And they said, they called this the revolving door syndrome. Well, that was a new description of what was happening with the use of antipsychotics. And there was even a study done in Boston that showed relapse rates were higher, that sort of thing. And my frustration is what you just said. So by the way, there's never been a good placebo-controlled trial of the efficacy of antipsychotics in medication-naive patients, never. We've never studied that. But what we hear in society is, oh, people come off the antipsychotics, they relapse, as if that's the return of the disease.
Yes.
But what really you see in these studies, they take chronic patients. By chronic patients, I mean people who've been on these drugs for some time, often 5-10 years, and then they withdraw. They withdraw everybody abruptly, and then they immediately randomize half back to the drug that they're used to, and the other they keep off. And of course, those who are now going through withdrawal, they relapse. We know that, but it's not the return of the disease. It's
right.
it's a medication withdrawal effect. For the very reason you said, their brains have been changed by being on the drug. And the frustration is everybody knows this. It's a charade to keep on doing this.
Well, and you talk about compassionate care and the Quakers. And, of course, a lot of people might be tempted to just toss that off. It was so long ago and there was no way to really study it. But then you talk about Mosher and Soteria. Can you tell us a little bit about that study and what that?
Yeah, and by the way, Soteria is really coming back now. And Israel's really beginning to embrace this approach to treating psychosis. So under the Quakers, and they start doing this in the late 1796, I think they opened their first retreat in New York, England. And the Quakers had this thought. At the time, there were all these madhouses in the UK where the people thrown in there were chained up and mistreated, that sort of thing. The Quakers said this: we don't know what causes madness, but we do know this, they're brethren. They're not the other, they're brethren. And as brethren, and as children of God, they have a natural capacity to recover their sanity. That's a possibility, okay? And if not, we have a moral obligation to provide a good shelter, good food, and a kind environment. So they open their York retreat, and if you can read descriptions of it, of course, they're not using medical treatments. They want to create a new environment. They think nature is healing. They think kindness is healing.
And they're not using medical doctors.
What's that?
They're not using medical doctors.
No, they're not using – it's not a medical approach. That's part of the thing. They don't want the mad doctors in there. And what you find – and they actually kept quite good records. You found, especially with the first episode people, the people nearly coming, the overwhelming majority got better with time. And there was exercise, good food. Yeah. So the Quakers' treatment involved exercise, good food, walks in nature, the idea is they would dine together. They'd have
they
a glass of
art.
Water. They'd do art. They might even, and they would, you know, write. They'd read. They'd have a glass of porter in the afternoon. And they kept good records. And what you find was with first episode people who hadn't been a long time in madhouses or something, the overwhelming percentage got better, okay, and discharged and didn't come back. Now, that sort of so-called moral therapy then was, you know, adopted by Quakers in the United States. Some of the first asylums, like McLean Hospital, was initially a moral therapy asylum. There was ones in Philadelphia, Hartford, et cetera. And they reported good results with first episode patients. The best long-term study came out of Worcester Asylum. And with first episode patients, something like 65% were discharged and never came back within the course of 30 years. Now, that's much better outcomes than we get to today. And by the way, if you look at their historians have gone back and look at their case descriptions, these people were seriously disturbed going into the hospitals. That's it. Anyway, we could talk about what happened, but that gets eventually discredited. And the reason it gets discredited is because we build these big asylums and communities, public asylums, and they start putting people with Alzheimer's in there, in stage syphilis, and the discharge rates go down. And then eugenics comes along. Anyway, in the 1970s, Lauren Mosher, who was then head of schizophrenia studies at the NIMH, said to himself, you know, we're not getting good results with our new form of care. People are revolving, going back into the hospitals. Let's try and see if environmental care can produce better outcomes. And so he set up an experiment where mostly newly diagnosed people with psychosis would either be treated, randomized to the hospital, or randomized to a home in the San Francisco area where others would just be with them. They'd cook together, they'd socialize together. There was no intention really on knocking out the crazy ideas. The idea was in these environments, people who might be very afraid of others would learn to be with others, learn to cook, and that this would help with that environment, without doctors, by the way, that was part of Lauren's idea, would the psychosis would begin to abate.
The psychosis would begin to abate.
Right. So in the study, those treated with Soteria, they had the same diminishment of psychotic symptoms over the short term than those treated conventionally in the hospital, okay? That was the six. And in terms of use of antipsychotics, it went like this. They tried not to give it immediately, because one of the ideas was people, in order to get through this crisis and respond to this crisis, they need to be able to mount emotional responses. That's part of a resilience and a healing process. And the drugs, of course, very much block emotional responses.
Right.
So this is one of the purposes of it. Now, if people weren't getting better after like a few weeks or 3 weeks, they might give them a low dose of an antipsychotic. And then after a time, they see who could come off. And I think at the end of 2 years, something like 40% had never been exposed to antipsychotics. Maybe another 40% had temporarily, and around 20% or something were on the drugs long term. And here's the thing. And this experiment ran for 10 years, two houses, was replicated. Their outcomes were better at the end of 2 years. They were more likely to be working in school and out of the hospital. So that was an experiment in modern times where a different approach, an environmental approach, an approach that didn't focus on just knocking down symptoms but really helped people get well, proved to be successful.
And
what
again,
happened?
And again, it was run by people who weren't physicians.
Yes, they did.
So that was a, that, that, create a very threatening situation for the physicians who are supposed to be the experts.
Exactly. Now, Lauren, of course, was a physician. He was educated at Harvard Medical School. But it earned him enemies for just precisely this reason. Because in essence, he said, we can shift the treatment of, you know, psychotic patients out of the hospital, which is a medical environment, and we don't need doctors. We just need people who can be with others in this time of extreme states. And, of course, what happened is he was forced out of the NIMH for that very reason, because it was such a threat. Now, the interesting thing is there were two other studies done at the same time by the NIMH that both found better outcomes for psychotic patients not treated with medications over a longer period of time, both of them. And one of the leaders even said, we have to start, a man named, a psychiatrist named William Carpenter said, we have to worry that these drugs, in fact, are making people more biologically vulnerable to psychosis. That's 1980. Again, and there was actually some research done by out of Canada that came forth with a biological explanation of why that was so. And they said, yes, many patients are developing what we call tardive psychosis, a permanent psychosis. And it was related to the brain's compensatory reaction to the drugs. But then this went against money, it went against the medical personnel, and it gets pushed away. Now, just what's frustrating, then we'll go up to what's happening with Soteria. The best long-term outcome study that has been done in the modern time was done by Thomas Jobe and Martin Harrell at the University of Illinois. Starting in the late 70s, early 80s, they recruit 200 it's mostly young patients, either first or second episode from two hospitals, one private, one public. Everyone's treated conventionally in the hospital with drugs. Then they're discharged, and Harrell and Jobe are just, it's a naturalistic thing. They're just going to follow them up at 2, 4.5, 7.5, 10, 15, and 20 years. At each follow-up, they're going to look at, are they symptomatic? Are they working? Are they socializing? And are they using medications? Now, their hypothesis was that those who choose to stop taking their medications will do real poorly. Well, they found exactly the opposite, and they've now published 7 or 8 papers. They found that the long-term recovery rates for those who took themselves off medication was 6 times higher than for those who were medication compliant and stayed on the drugs. And by the way, they also found this. By year 2, a number of people diagnosed with schizophrenia had taken themselves off medication, but they were still psychotic, as were the people on the drugs, by the way. What did they see over the next 2.5 years? So this is a longer course than what you see in a 6-week trial. They saw that they became stable. By the end of 4.5 years, something only like 10% were actively psychotic. But here's the interesting thing is, these people that stopped taking drugs left care. What Harrell and Jobe did is they had the brilliance to follow them into the community and find out how they were doing. And by the way, those who got stable off meds, almost no one relapsed over the rest of that study. So that completely belies the idea that the medications reduce the risk of relapse. And by the way, they published 6-7 articles on this. They've looked at this data from every possible angle, and now there's been other studies from other countries that in essence have replicated the sense that on the whole, recovery rates are higher for unmedicated patients. And then finally, you know, you have a form of care out of northern Finland where they tried to be very environmentally focused. It's called Open Dialogue. And they started this in 1990. What were their outcomes? At the end of 5 years, 80% of their patients, first episode patients, are working or back in school and asymptomatic and off antipsychotics. That was the results from their first 5-year study.
80%.
80%. Now, that seems so high, but I just want to say, in the decade before the arrival of antipsychotics, you would see cohort studies that said, at the end of 3 to 5 years, anywhere from 65 to 80% would be living in the community, and there was no social service. In other words, they had to be working and that sort of thing. So it's sort of a reflection of some of the outcomes we were seeing before the arrival of antipsychotics. And finally, going back to Soteria, there is a revival of this approach in a little bit in the United States, but particularly in Israel. They have a number of Soteria houses opening up. with the idea of being with people, and they seem to be flourishing.
I was flipping through here as you were wrapping up there, your epilogue, which is looking at some lessons that can be learned from, you know, the masterful presentation you've done of the data, of the history. And one of the things that is so critical that you've mentioned a couple times here is actually talking to the people who receive the services as though they're human beings and they've got an experience that's valid and that the feedback from that experience might inform care. Well, if you're into that model of eugenics and you're thinking these are inferior beings to begin with, then there's no reason to ask them how they liked it or if they felt it was good. But when you look at people who've been in psychiatric hospital care in the allopathic model, which is medicate, 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 and restrain, 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 and ask them how they liked it, you get a very different picture from the people who were in the Quaker houses or in the Soteria houses.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is, I think, such an important point. In medicine, we do know that, as a general rule, you need to listen to your patients and listen from them and learn from them. But in psychiatry, precisely because so often the patients didn't like these aggressive medical treatments, which really had the purpose of silencing them and quieting them, they often rejected treatments, including antipsychotics. In fact, it was the introduction of antipsychotics that really helped create a psychiatric survivor movement in the 1970s. So how did psychiatry respond to people being released saying, we hate these drugs? They make us feel like zombies. We can't have real lives. They said, these people lack insight into their illness and they don't know they're sick. So they adopted as a primary sort of mode of care, not listening to their patients.
Exactly.
And that's just a prescription for bad outcomes and bad medicine. And I just want to add one thing to what you just said here is, how do we conceive of people who are having this, let's say a psychotic episode or manic episode or any of these sort of extreme states? Are they like us or are they the other? Are they abnormal or are they just in the spectrum of what human beings are? And in alternatives, starting with the Quakers, there's no effort to say, oh, here's the abnormal people and here's the normal people. It's like, hey, human beings are, you know, our minds are a difficult place. They go to crazy places, and we don't really know why these things happen, but they are brethren. And if you start with that, you get a whole different form of care as opposed to they're the other, we need to be afraid of them, they're violent and all this sort of thing. So this conception is so critical, I think, to everything that follows.
So what's the, you know, you say at the top of the wish list for things that could be different, honesty is at the top of that list, right? The idea that, you know, can we actually get the drug companies and or the physicians that are prescribing these things to be honest with people about what they can expect and what they really know and don't know.
Right.
As you know, it is an extraordinarily complex web of things at this point in time. The Zyprexa papers, the billions of dollars that are at stake that are funneled into marketing directly to the doctors, or, you know, the kind of, I don't know what kind of negative words I should use, the idea of the abuse, in my personal opinion, the abuse of letting drug companies market directly to patients. Ask your doctor.
Right.
And what your doctor going to tell you, because your doctor has been trained in the system that was funded by the drug companies to begin with.
Right.
So what can you tell us about the movements that are going? I know you're somewhat connected to people and you have some connections. The person that introduced me to you works with, you know, like the Survivor Network or, you know, consumer advocacy. what is your awareness of how it's moving? You say it is changing, and the Satoria is coming back in, did you say, in Israel and in the U.S.?
Israel, and there's some Satoria houses in the U.S. popping up. And the open dialogue therapy that was promoted in northern Finland is becoming quite popular in countries. And there's something called the Hearing Voices Network that's really growing here and elsewhere. Here's what's happening. That old narrative really has collapsed, even among those within that narrative. So it's openly admitted now the chemical imbalance theory did not pan out. That's number one. Within the biological psychiatry community. Two, you know, for a long time we heard that these are discrete illnesses of the brain, they're biological disorders. And therefore depression is a discrete illness, ADHD is a discrete illness, schizophrenia, et cetera. Well, what you see among experts in diagnosis are saying these are constructs, folks. We really haven't validated any of these as real disorders. And for example, Stephen Hyman, talking about the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, said it's a book of horrors or something to that effect. And then, you know, an Anatomy of an Epidemic did help this. There is increasing look at the long-term outcomes, and no one has been able to say that they're good. So that whole story of medical progress has actually, within the scientific community, collapsed. Now, when you have one narrative collapse, it makes it opens up the possibility for a paradigm shift, a rethinking, and I think that's where we're at. And here's two examples of how this is bubbling up. The UN Special Rapporteur for Health, Danius Puris, he recently left. He wrote a paper when he was done calling for a revolution in mental health. And he said, we need to pay attention to social factors, poverty, inequality, poor housing, poor diet. And we need to put much less emphasis on drugs, which haven't led us to the promised land. We need to rethink this whole thing. Now, when he put that out, he got a lot of pushback. But nevertheless, this was coming from someone, the UN Special Rapporteur for Health, calling for revolution. Now, I will tell you, I run something called Mad in America website. We even had people from our staff that were contributing to his sort of drafts because he really appreciated, I think, how we were both deconstructing the existing science and pointing to other possibilities. Second, just last week, the World Health Organization, the World Health Organization put out a big study, a big analysis document calling for a paradigm shift as well, a paradigm shift in mental health along the same lines. They even quoted Danius Puris and they said, we got to have more Satorias. We got to have less emphasis on meds. We need to have consider social factors. We need to have human rights factors. We got to stop forcing people into treatment and locking them up. So here you have two big bodies saying what's been working, what's been told to us isn't really true. It's not working, and we need something different. So that is really opening up possibilities. Like Soteria is even sort of being embraced by the Ministry of Health. Now, how about in Norway? Norway, the Minister of Health ordered all of its four health districts, it has a national health service, but there's sort of four providers, to start providing medication-free treatment to psychiatric patients for those who want it. There's a hospital that opened up near Oslo that calls itself the first medication-free hospital for psychiatric patients. Now, actually, it's a place where people who usually go who been in the care and now want to get off the meds. But my point is, I think we're at an inflection point. We're a moment where we say, okay, what we've been doing for the past 40 years in particular has failed. Disability rates, by the way, have risen in every developed country. Our kids hit age 18 now, and it's like 25% have a diagnosis. Anyway, and we also know that that whole story was a corrupt story fueled by pharma money and frankly, some guild interests. So we're at a moment now we can re-envision what we do. And I think that's happening. A lot of it is bubbling up from grassroots. But it's really getting traction. It really is. The Hearing Voices networks are spreading. The Open Dialogue networks are spreading. Satoria-type houses are spreading. And you are seeing from the top, like the World Health Organization, like the UN Special Rapporteur for saying, like, listen, environments matter. Environments matter. So if you have bad environments and you have traumatic environments, you're going to have people suffer and struggle, and we need to bring that into our thinking. And if environments matter in causing problems, proper, better environments can also be pathways to recovery as well. So honestly, I think we're, you know, there are a lot of guild interests, there are a lot of financial interests that don't want to hear any of this. But there is a growing movement for wholesale change. And by the way, the public isn't happy with that sort of medication, that disease model of care either. They want something different. They want it different for their children too, because that's been a disaster. So that's where I think we're at. I think we're at for a possible rethinking, a reconceptualization, away from this disease model, away from the medical model, to what the World Health Organization said. We need a human rights model, and part of human rights is, you know, right to shelter, right to food, and that sort of thing.
Well, and the other word you slipped in there, you know, traumatic environments, trauma, recognizing if you're looking for, most of us in the Western culture want a simple cause and effect relationship, and we're, as human beings, the mind, the emotions, the connection energetically to the body is not just that simple. There's a lot of different factors in there. But more and more people are recognizing, whether they're trained in integrative medicine or functional medicine or holistic approaches, trauma is one of those really strong complicating factors. And addressing the traumas and the resolution of the effects of past traumas is one of the best ways to get improved outcomes.
Right. You know, if you think of a trauma, and by the way, you know, when I was writing Anatomy of an Epidemic, I think I interviewed somewhere between 80 to 100 people. Just ask them their stories. And especially those who had a diagnosis of schizophrenia or bipolar, so many of them told of difficult childhoods. I mean, it's just true. They talked about being bullied or and not being safe at the home, that sort of thing. So they weren't, as youth, in places that felt safe. They weren't afraid. So there was a stress and isolation even as children. And so I think if we start thinking of this, one of the solutions, in my opinion, to trauma, beyond whatever sort of therapeutic things in terms of addressing that, et cetera, is how can you create non-traumatic environments today for people,
right,
where they can be with others, they can socialize with others, they can find meaning, they can find love. So that conception leads to a whole different understanding of what is possible.
Well, and what you're talking about there is so beautifully represented in Gabor Mate's book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, and the harm reduction movement is getting at exactly what you're talking about. Maybe we can't go back and undo the old traumas, but we can help create environments in the present moment that leave people feeling safe and connected and a part of community and having a sense of worth and...
Yeah, and meaning in life, right? We all need meaning in life. I mean, we need everything you just said. Having a sense of warmth and, you know, worth and that sort of thing. But that's, think about how different that is from a disease model that says to people, you're abnormal and you're going to be abnormal. You have an abnormal brain and you're going to be abnormal for the rest of your life. Good luck. Take the drug. Now, which story, let's say you're struggling, depression, mania, whatever, mania. Which narrative do you want to be greeted with? Which one do you want to try to inhabit as you go forward with your life?
The one that's got some hope.
Exactly. I mean, it's just, it's so simple in a way. I mean, we all know that hope is central to, you know, recovery from a lot of medical disorders, to be honest with you, a lot of disorders.
Yeah, and it is, to me, it's very heartening to continue to interview people like you and then other practitioners who are willing to go the extra mile and get trained in functional medicine after they get their regular medical degree or in integrative approaches. And the hope is that we'll get people as consumers that say, I don't want to go to somebody who isn't willing to work with me and ask me how I like what we're doing, right? If I'm going to go to somebody who's going to view me as defective and lesser than them and somebody who can't make decisions about his or her own life, then I'm going to get a whole different outcome than if I find somebody who's willing to work with me.
Yeah, I think there is a rising tide of that approach among people who, you know, come as patients or come seeking help, that they want to have agency, they want to be listened to. You know, if you talk to people who are frustrated or have done poorly with the current disease model, medical model, one of the things they always talk about is they didn't care about me. They didn't listen to me. They never even asked me what my problem was.
Or so, if they ask you, do you want this medication, and then you say no, then they go and get a court order to be able to force it on you anyway.
Exactly. But I think as part of this change, there is a groundswell among ordinary folks for something different.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that your books, both of them, have contributed to that. I greatly appreciate your willingness to take the time to talk to us here today. Is there something that we haven't even touched on yet that you'd want to put in here before we wrap up?
Well, I guess real quickly, you know, I do run this website called madinamerica.com that is devoted to sort of rethinking psychiatry. And one of the things that we do is we try to feature stories of people with lived experience. We cover the science, we have resources, et cetera, but we regularly, every week, we have a story from someone with lived experience. And the point is to bring that into the societal discussion. So I'd say to your listeners, if you have experiences that you'd like to, to make your story known, you know, write us. And we're looking for stories of people with lived experience. It's always been an essential, almost central part of what we do.
Wonderful. Well, I appreciate your time more than you'll know, and I look forward to the next book you might happen to write.
Okay, if I can just find some time. Anyway, thank you very much for having me. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, that was awesome. So you'll be able to pick that back up if you didn't hear all of that interview with Robert Whitaker. You'll be able to pick it up in the archives. And I'll welcome you to the second hour of Mind Shifters Radio. Today is Monday, August the 30th, 2021. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And I'll welcome, press 1 to talk to us, and that'll put you in queue. I'm going to welcome Michael, and then I'm also going to welcome Michelle.
Sweet. Welcome, everybody. Delighted that you're here. And ready to rock and roll. Michelle, how are you, young lady?
I'm fine.
Oh, good. What's on your mind today?
Well, I re-listened to the show, and, you know, being a couple days away from when we originally talked and kind of putting myself back into my own shoes and then hearing how I answered and really putting effort to try to identify what it is that I was incomplete with in terms of my commitment to my family. I guess I am not feeling anything that feels strong or that I have like a judgment on or like a strong emotion towards. You know, I
awesome.
Think like, okay, like mom guilt. I was trying to think about things like with my kids that I, you know, judged in the past and, you know, try to sort of ferret out something there. I, you know, with my stepkids, I know that there were things that, you know, that they reacted poorly to. But when I think about, like, how I went into these relationships, I feel like I was doing the best I could. I feel like I was getting a lot of help along the way. So I was going through different possibilities, my family of origin, with my mom. I'm like, well, you know, could I have found forgiveness work faster and maybe saved a couple years in terms of my resistance to being open to that relationship? And I'm like, well, you know, I mean, I found forgiveness when I found forgiveness. So
probably it's the perfect time.
I'm open to you giving me some ideas, but I just am, I don't, I'm not feeling the hot spot that I'm supposed to.
Right. Well, I'm glad you're not. You know, you're getting to experience the fruit of your work. One of the things that struck me in our conversation and why I suggested maybe we continue it today is that the word we use to describe what we do when we write something down is to spell something, and spelling. And, of course, we look at that. There are two different definitions, at least for that word. One is it's the way that we put letters together to make a word. But the other one is to put one into a state of hypnosis, into a spell. And I noticed that when you first introduced the topic of your divorce and mentioned your former's name, that you used the word unnecessary in describing his leaving the relationship. And I think that word was used once or twice more in the conversation. And what really struck me at that moment and why I wanted to, you know, it wasn't topical to go into that in the time we had on the show on Friday, but it seemed like a good opportunity to present an idea to the whole audience about how we use words to form the perceptual constructs that we have. And, you know, state of hypnosis is one where the mind is controlled and its perceptual constructs are structured by the words in hypnosis, usually the words that another uses. You know, we can take somebody who is having a particular experience, and if they go into what we call a somnambulistic state of hypnosis, another person can feed them words, and the mind will totally change its perceptual construct about anything. You know, you've heard me before use the example of somebody standing on a stage, and a stage hypnotist says, when they're in that somnambulistic state, now you're standing on the deck of a ship. Now this person looks down and they see a stage. Their brain produces an image of that's relatively accurate about the stage, and they know they're standing on a stage. But when the hypnotist's words take over the perceptual mind, all of a sudden they literally, I mean the brain produces a perceptual construct, a picture of them standing on a ship. And so that word was the word in our whole conversation that really stood out to me most powerfully, that when you think in terms of that whole experience from your former's point of view, being categorizing it as unnecessary, then your mind is going to be limited by that word, and you keep perceiving everything related to it as unnecessary. And my offering would be that you might want to substitute the word necessary and see what else your mind shows you. You might find that there's a big difference in taking that limit off of perception's ability to show you what's really going on.
So how would I approach that? Saying, like, you know, like considering the idea that this divorce was necessary?
Well, I'm just suggesting that it will give you the possibility of your mind showing you things that when you're committed to, it's unnecessary, that mind simply won't show you. And
no, I love
once
that.
We
I like that. My
hypnotize,
that.
Yeah, once we set the mind up to see things a certain way, then the mind just makes up whatever it needs to, you know, to hallucinate a reality so that I can keep believing what I've told my mind to show me. And when I can see more evidence that would be blocked by such a concept, maybe I'll see where, you know, I played into it and made it necessary, and it gives me the opportunity to perhaps act differently, to correct things, to forgive things that might change the dynamic of whatever it is. And, you know, of course, this is just an example. It can go in any arena of life. To use language that opens my mind to showing me as much evidence as possible rather than blocking any evidence. But when I say, well, that's unnecessary, my mind has to go, okay, then I'll only show you evidence that shows that it's unnecessary. And it might be useful to shift into, well, you know, maybe in my former's mind, this was necessary, and start to look at what, why, what evidence can I see, or what have I blocked in myself that might be useful to look at and be able to change, have the power to change. We can't change what we can't see.
So the first thing that came to my mind playing around with it, like, so I can make up a story on this one. And the story I made up was, this was necessary because he did what I could never do.
Which is?
Be the one to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Well, and we tie it into your later conversation. Go ahead.
I was thinking that maybe, if you know, on some soul level, that I was accepting the relationship for what it was and knowing that it was unfulfilling because of, you know, fill in the blank, his Crohn's disease, his, you know, mental health issues, whatever, but that I would never be the one to not accept my husband. Like, I'm not going to be the one to end this relationship because I committed. Mm-hmm. Like, the righteousness of having my integrity is maybe more important than being happy. I'm going to leave you and go find someone better because that doesn't feel right either.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I hear you. Well, later in the latter part of the conversation, when I asked you if you looked at him truly, and I don't remember exactly what your words were, but there was something to the effect of, well, I wouldn't have anything to do with him.
Yeah, I was being crass.
Yeah, okay.
And okay, so again, then words fly up, right?
Yeah, and my thoughts remain below. So I want to look at everything because if I don't look at that factor, if there's a factor in there that I block, then I'm going to get to live the title of my book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? Because that factor is going to come into the next interaction, the next relationship. If I clear it out of me, then I'm going to be able to really, truly create something totally and completely different if I choose to create another relationship.
No, I remember one radio show with you on this topic, and it was 4.5 years ago, and I had this joy for about maybe 10 days that this is exactly what I wanted, and I was really happy about it, and this was going to be a transformative time in my life, and then I lost it. So I know.
Well, my offering would be you didn't lose it. Yeah, my offering would be you didn't lose it. What my offering would be is you didn't lose it. You hit a new clarity and goal for your mind, and everything that would block that had to come to the surface for healing. It's kind of like a mind shifter. High level of connected joy energy was like a mind shifter, and now your task in order to achieve it is to clean up everything in your mind that goes against it. So all the grief, all the rage, all the sadness, all the pain, all the drama, all the trauma, it's going to have to be cleared out, or I will seem to lose it, but really it's buried by what that mind shifter surfaces. So I would support you creating a mind shifter out of what you just said there, and doing that mind shifter. I have such delight and joy, and now choose to create my life as I really choose. And then, you know, like, and this would be a really important one. I take 4 hours. I'd block out the phones. I'd shut off my cell phone, everything. And I'd sit for 4 hours and I'd write that mind shifter and see, as I do a brain dump, what's under it that buried that joy. You know, there's a paleontologist Catholic priest named Kilhar de Chardin. And he has an awesome definition. I actually add one word to it. But he has an awesome definition of joy. He says, joy is the infallible sign of the presence of God. Now, I adjust that just a little bit, because if that were true, joy would always be present, because the Creator is always present. The love is always present. But joy is the infallible sign of the awareness of the presence of God. And so if joy came to me, that means that love was fully present in my structure. And now everything less than that, I need to process through in order to really own that and live with that for eternity. Breathing?
Yeah.
Because you deserve. Your natural state is to live in joy 24/7 for the rest of eternity. That's your natural state. Anything less than that is an aberration of the mind. And, you know, you've heard me say it 1,000 times. In order to really be in that state, you've got to be out of your mind. But when you took that in for that 10 days and were with it, your mind, again, it acted like a mind shifter. Your mind just brought up everything. And, you know, what it brought up would be things from your life, from your relationships, from your genetics, from your family system, from your cultural system that need to be healed. Every frequency, every vibration, that the empowerment of being in that state of joy would bring up for you. And there's your next layer of forgiveness work.
While we've been talking so far today, one thing I just thought of, which is like, related to, let's say, the work that I've done on Mark, and, you know, how many times I canceled the goal to be married to Mark, and
right,
all the things related, that I didn't necessarily get the result I wanted, so to speak, with my husband. And that was always never promised, you know, assured me that that was not approaching things. But that after all that work, I got a huge result with my mom, because I didn't really do much work on her during mm-hmm. that whole time. So you know how you say, like,
right,
oh, do your work on your parents and the marriage will work out? I did work on my marriage and then my mom worked out.
Yeah, it all fits together. You know, the work I need to do is the work I need to do. I can perceive that it comes from and has to do with someone or something. But the truth is, everywhere that interfering energy comes in will improve as I do the piece of work, whether it's, you know, on the person I look at in the mirror that, let's say, there's rage at, or the spouse that there's rage at, or the parent that there's rage at, or the government there's rage at, or whoever it is. If I'll do that piece of work, rage is going to start to disappear from my life and relationships. And I'm going to get to live as a human being, as the presence of love. Now, that doesn't mean everything that I want to have happen is going to happen, but I'm going to tend to create openings for amazing, wondrous, and wonderful things to occur. I'm going to get to look inside of my structure at places where energetic patterns have been held perhaps for literally 100 generations that I need to clean out. And every perceptual construct related to that issue is going to change. Whoever or whatever my mind tells me it's about. You know, people say I'm angry at Joe or Bill or whatever. Nobody's ever been angry at anybody ever in their lives. Nobody has ever been angry with anybody. They're just people who are angry. Now, they can put their anger into their picture of Joe or Bill or Harry or Mary or, you know, the door that didn't close properly, and they kick it and break their foot. You know, I was angry at the door. Get out of here. You weren't angry at the door. You just had anger, and, you know, you put it into your brain's image of the door, and you kick the stupid door, you know. and as we realize that, you know, we've never been sad about anything. We've never been hateful about anything. We've never been fearful about anything. But if there's hate and there's fear and there's sadness in us, I can put it into anything. You know, I can, my rage, and put it into the fact that I dropped my pen and my favorite pen and the tip broke. I'm going to fit a rage about that. I'm really angry because, has anybody ever been angry because they've broken a pen? No. But they've been, their brains told them they've been angry about that. There's just anger. There's just sadness. There's fear. There's, and these things get placed in our perceptual construct, projected into our perceptual constructs. And as long as we think it's about that, it's like that state of hypnosis. When I tell my mind it's about that, here's the instruction I give to my mind. Evidential mind, you are only allowed to show me that this rage is about that. Rather than when I realize the truth of it, my perceptual, my instruction to my perceptual mind is, mind, damn, I have rage. I have such rage, and I realize I need to, and I want to look at it, and I want to clean it up. And now I'm going to go to a different part of my mind and have access to the ability to forgive it, to remove it, rather than get lost in it.
One of the things, when I re-listened to the broadcast, is I redid the exercise, and I paid attention to my hands because you had asked about any sensations, and I did feel like there was a frequency around me when I was really concentrating, and I definitely felt it. But then I was thinking, okay, are you just feeling that because you are thinking you should feel it? And so then I started to overthink it, but I felt like, you know what, that's something that I could, you know, just do on a regular basis and send them blessings and be on your way.
You know, there's a great show that Dr. Tim did when he interviewed Pierre Pradovan, The Gentle Art of Blessings. In the context of that statement, you might want to go back and find that in the archives. And it was a powerful show.
Pierre
Pradovan. He's got a book out there called The Gentle Art of Blessing.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim interviewed him live. I think he was in France or somewhere at the time he interviewed him. But, you know, it's a, to take charge of the evidential mind and consciously operate the evidential mind rather than let it operate you changes everything. You know, the Harvard research that we've talked about that says that, you know, in the time frame where 10,000 brain cells are firing, the max amount of data that goes into our conscious perceptual constructs is 9 bits, a little tiny bit. And most people are run by the law of resonance. You know, this or that or the next thing or the next person resonates this, and that's what fills the 9-bit mind. And I go, oh, I have that about that, and I'm being run by my mind rather than me running my mind. Go back to Yeshua, and he says, you know, to be the master bound by the servants in your own temple, your own household, is a tragedy. And most people, I mean, our culture teaches us to be run by our minds because that makes us very good slaves and servants to the king.
I had another thought when you were talking about the mind shifter, and I don't know. I mean, you said a lot of things there. I don't know that you actually got to like formulating a full one. But I was thinking that maybe on this topic about, you know, unnecessarily breaking your commitment to your family and where that might have some more roots was, this time I was doing a mind shifter with Rex, and he had a workshop in Lansing. It was like a breath session, and there was probably 20-plus people there. And my mind shifter was along the lines of, you know, my guilt heals my relationship with my mom or something. I'm like, what? I don't have any guilt. Never have. Like, I'm a victim here, so not sure how the perpetrator is the one who have the guilt. So I worked on it for a half an hour, and I'm so frustrated with the thing, that I just stopped early, and we ended up breathing early. So it was just like, okay, this is dumb. And I thought, well, if you win some, you lose one, I guess. Maybe I didn't pick. And then it was a week later, and I was in Pompano in Florida at Sally's house. This is like in 2013. And Dr. Tim
right.
was doing the radio show, and he was hosting. I don't know where you were, but, you know, they were talking about it, about this idea of guilt, or somehow it got brought up. And all of a sudden, boom, it like hit me, and I started crying uncontrollably. I had a head in the walk-in closet because I was so loud sobbing, because this feeling of guilt and realizing that if I had been a better daughter, then I wouldn't have been abused. And if I had been a better person and more lovable, then I would have been cared for and considered and honored and all those things. And it like there was so much guilt, I just couldn't believe it. And it was very helpful, because I was in the company of, you know, 20 other women that week, whatever it was. And
right.
So I'm thinking, maybe
I was in Jeannie's
Women
Healing Women workshop.
Her commencement.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be there. And that's where I actually met Nancy Lynn. It was great. We on sometimes weekends doing healing work and talking about things. So
cool.
I'm going to ask Holy Spirit, I suppose, that maybe that would be the best way to, like, let's see. Okay. I'm open to exploring what needs to be healed related to my, like, family commitment.
Well, I certainly hold the space for that. I mean, that's such a big issue on the planet. You know, globally. I mean, globally. You know, you go back and you look at, you know, the global conflicts. You look at, you know, the Arabs and the Jews are brothers. And look at the family conflict, you know. And that's just one example. And, you know, at what point do we really take on and stand in the willingness to let whatever patterns are in us surface for healing? It's monumental.
Hmm. Yeah.
You sound like you're moving into a very pensive space.
Because it's more observing different things and how energies move. What I was thinking about was that sort of out of the blue, my niece from my first marriage, who really isn't even related to me anymore, and I didn't see her during her growing up years. She's 21 now, and she's struggling, and she's reaching out to me. And then she has this, you know, image of me as her, you know, Aunt Michelle that she can come and, like, you know, ask advice to and lean on. And I was like, how does she even know me? Like, it's just interesting, her perspective. And I'm like, oh, course, sure, I'll come on over and we'll spend some time. And, you know, spent the day with her, dinner and swimming and all kinds of stuff. And just talking to her and really just holding the space as she kind of figures things out, pulled some tarot cards for her. But then her uncle, my brother-in-law, texted me, and he texted me for the first time in, like, I don't know, 5 years,
right,
about some random thing. And I was like, you know what I mean? To me, that was like so interesting, because I felt the sense that this, my niece's mom, who died of alcoholism, and my former husband, who died of bipolar and related, you know, had alcoholism. So it's like their two souls are, I felt like they were present during our day with me and my niece. And then for the other part of the call, it was just such a, like, I'm thinking about the whole thing, how every healing situation it's kind of like that. You don't know necessarily what's going on between the scenes, behind the scenes, how things are being pulled together, what makes it different for who and when and why. And just so I kind of got lost in that when we were just talking about the whole healing process, because everybody's healing. All the family relationships are healing. The Bumgarten family is healing.
And notice that everybody's perceptual constructs are so different. Like, you know, what I heard you say was to you, like there was really never any relationship with her. Her perceptual construct was there was full-blown relationship with you and a trusting relationship with you. Like, what have you blocked that you weren't aware of that, and what is she open to that she is and is willing to come to you? I mean, that's monumental.
I was like, who, me? What do you mean? People have to pay me to come to me. Brianna, what do you want to, you just want to come to me?
And you know what that's called? It's called family commitment.
Oh, well. Yeah, I felt that.
I mean, how awesome is that, that young lady, however it occurred for her, maybe because it was a full-blown relationship that you weren't aware of, or maybe it's one that she fantasized, but she has that reality, that construct in her mind. I mean, how could our reality be so different?
I think, you know, she knows that I was really close with her mom. And yesterday she was asking me, she's like, well, what stories do you have about my mom? And so, like, I was just going, you know what I mean? Story after story. And I know she was just, like, filled. Like, getting her out of my house, I'm, like, on the porch and lingering. You're like, bye. You know, it's like, she's like, what? And she's like, well, maybe I can see you before you go to Mexico. Like, okay, well, you can come and live with me if you want. And then you guys got to go. So I don't know. We'll see what unfolds. But I do like that idea, because I do feel like he had reached out to her, the other uncle, and I realized that even though I was the in-law, that, you know, I embraced it more fully than the other relative that she had reached out, and that I felt really good about that. And until you labeled it, I didn't even realize why that was so important to me.
Yeah, that's awesome. What a gift. What a gift for her to give you, to remind you, and what a gift for you to be able to stand there for her, because that's what family does, unless we're blocked, and then family doesn't want to do that.
Wow, I didn't think I was going to cry out of this reason.
Well, I just joined you in briefing, and you know, it sounds like there's a little bit of grief moving. Like, what did you miss out with her?
Well, no, it's kind of weird grief and joy. No, it's grief and joy. Yeah. Like, wow, it really was such a blessing. And she kept finding pennies around my house, and pennies is her thing with my mom. You know, that's pretty common. But I, you know, I'm a kind of housekeeper. Like, if there's change, I pick it up, and I have a special little drawer. So even if it's pennies, they're not lying around. I'm like, damn, Brianna, like, you just bring that juju to the house. So it was a good weekend, but it's nice to talk to you about it.
Yeah, it's powerful. I mean, if we can't turn to family, who can we turn to? You know, and most of the world doesn't have anybody to turn to. You know, most people are out there both alone and lonely.
Well,
with nobody they can trust.
Well, the idea that you connect with the people who want to connect with you. I mean, one thing that when I was talking to my niece yesterday and realizing that she's the same age as my stepdaughter,
and that these two little babies born in the same, you know, year, and how the one who I poured myself into rejects me and doesn't want anything to do with me, and the one that, you know, cared about from afar is the one who, you know, really needs, like, what I have to offer, and that it really doesn't matter that, you know, my heart is filled because I can, like, share wisdom with somebody who's struggling, because when you're in 20, that's what you do. So, it's just,
so it sounds like time to take her to lunch before you go to Mexico.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I guess so. I you know what I told her, because Alyssa does only has a one-way ticket. She didn't buy a round trip. And so I have no idea when she's coming home from Europe. So I took Bri up to Alyssa's bedroom, and I said, go on the bed. I'm going to take a picture. And I'm sending it to Alyssa, and I say, I have a new daughter. And so I invite her. I said, yeah, you can come. If Liz doesn't come home, you can stay here and take care of the animals and just sleep in her room, and you can be my daughter. And I, you know, at some level, I think she likes that. She, you know, this is her mom. Died too early.
Yeah. Hmm. That's powerful.
So that was unexpected. Opening for probably a new relationship that probably, you know, go as far as I want to take it.
Well, and, you know, thinking in terms of healing the family dynamics, this is where it happens. You know, as you change your genetics, and, you know, at 20, she probably doesn't have a clue that's even possible. And you open that space for her. Literally, everybody in the family gets to shift with the work that you do with her. And a lot of times, family's not even interested. But that's where the effort and the work is redoubled. You know, it's like kind of like it comes back to you, would be my take, in ways that it doesn't come back from people that you're not genetically connected to.
I'm not sure if I know exactly what you're saying. Can you say that a different way?
Yeah. If I'm the early adopter in this work, and I do a ton of work, I'm going to impact everybody in my family system. But my impact is probably going to be, you know, something like 2%. So, you know, I'll see changes happening around the family system. But if there's somebody else in the same genetic line that goes, oh, I'm ready for this, the work I do with them, instead of seeing what might be a 2% change if I'm the only one doing it, might be a 60% change in the whole family system. And reinforces everything in me that changes in them, and vice versa.
Mm.
Because we are energetic beings, and it's like, you know, there's the mathematical progression effect when you start adding family members doing their work.
Mm.
Energetically.
Right. Well, I know that when I look back, my brother, who is in good graces with my mom, definitely he said something kind of to me, like, you know, none of this would have happened without me. And if I didn't come back from Billings and I wasn't living here. And I'm like, okay, fair enough. I agree. And it's true. He, you know, he was also very desirous of the family being repaired. And I think it bothered him a lot that my mom was so cruel to me, and that my brothers and sisters, you know, jumped on this Mussolini pile, and then they were all kind of against me. And he used to call himself Switzerland. And he's like, hey, Michelle didn't kill bad. Like, Michelle's fine. Y'all need to get over yourself. And he's held that stand for 16 years. And so maybe not the formal healing work that I've done, but in his own way really held a space for the family.
That's pretty awesome. He'd probably appreciate a written acknowledgement of how you're seeing that.
Okay.
Really, seriously.
Oh, I know.
You know, one of the deepest needs that people have is just to be seen and accepted. And clearly he's put a lot of effort into that. And what a gift to offer it back to him and acknowledge it.
No, that's really a great idea. That's really a good idea.
I mean, when you talk about for 16 years he's held that, he's said it to different people, that's huge. When he could have just gone along with, you know, everybody else's, you know, distorted perception.
No, he calls himself a triple agent because, you know, he's good with everybody, even though that they might be enemies on the side, right? And one time I caught him, like, you know, two-timing me because he'll, you know, it's manipulative, but it's kind of playful too. I understand how it is. He goes, "You don't understand the work of a triple agent." So. You know, in his own world, he's orchestrating and all the players to get old. You know, he'll probably talk to my mom, you know, relax a little, let Michelle's okay, or to me, you know, quit being so, you know, righteous or whatever. So I do see where you're the concept that if more people in a family system are doing work, that they can, like, synergize and get there quicker.
And when you see that in him, when people are seen and acknowledged, it has a profound impact. Just profound.
No, I agree. When
because
I was in Mexico,
in our culture. Go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking about Carrie Ellis. When I was in Mexico,
mm-hmm.
Right. She did that for me every day. She would remind me, you know, how capable or how accomplished or how, you know, lovable and just, you know, really it is magical when you're having other people being witness to that and verbally expressing it. That's why I agree. I'm take your idea. We'll work on that.
Cool. Sweet. I could just see a really nice card acknowledgement and putting it in writing to him. And I mean, I can almost feel his heart cockles warming in response to that.
No, yeah, because sometimes I think he feels that he got screwed over in life because he never got married and he never really had, professional acclaim, and so, you know, he believes his purpose was being there for my sister Melanie, who has Down syndrome, and helping out the family in that way. But I agree that his opportunities for that level of acknowledgement just weren't expanded in his life. So did Angie call back, or did Angie come back on Monday here?
I don't know. Let's check with Jeannie. Angie, if you're out there and you have something to share with us, probably put your hand out.
Did Angie, or I thought Sunny was going to call in.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm sorry. That's right.
Angie called in Friday.
There is a hand up. So let's see. Area code 727. You're on the air.
Oh, that's Florida.
Hi, can you hear me?
Hey there, 727. We loud and clear.
Good and good and good. It's Patrick.
Hey, Patrick.
A parallel. Hi. In a conversation we're having and a desire that I have or goal that I could like to get more answers. But it's also a parallel in the work that you do. When you used to travel and people were in pain in their life and relationships with life and people, and you would give them short things each night, and they would get a breakthrough and they would feel a relief of their pain, then they would be motivated to get into your work more. And I found that I was able to avoid major things, take tests were really great 23, 24 years ago, but still managed to avoid the pain of facing my pain myself. So I'm thinking of this. I thought of it and thought of it in your work, how to not have people drop out or delay so long. And then I thought of it in relationship to what we call waking up in the matrix, maybe. So for me, in all things, there's polarities, and in all things, there's good on both ends of the polarity. And the polarity that I'm thinking of is all the questions on solutions for COVID. So with my children, and I find this also parallel to be true in every way for everyone, they're in a what I would call, you know, a sphere, a bubble, their reality. They've chosen what they feel to right that is right, which I think we all do. All of our egos have decided what we think and what we think about, what we believe, because we think we're pretty good and we're right. So when anybody has a discussion, they generally, everybody generally, wants to just prove that they're right and not listen or be open to the opposite. Now, Krishnamurti, who was touted to be originally the Christ of the New Age, but turned it down due to saying what I heard or what I read was, he overshot the mark, but his main teaching was that we needed to listen to each other. We needed to, you know, Christian to Muslim, blah, blah, blah. And intake the other person's viewpoint, the other, but I don't find that to be true hardly ever at all, hardly ever in anyone. So I'm looking at the reasons why. I think it has to do with, you know, my studies, like on the COVID go, and on things like, I say, Republican and Democratic, socialism and capitalism. I go back and forth to the assets of both. Look at that the flux and flow creates a better world, but if you just had one, you're over capitalistic, the heck with everybody. You're over socialistic, no motivation to work. That I've found over the years. So I try to find the best in both, and right now my major goal interest is in seeing if I can influence my children to look at both sides of any question, especially I'm looking at early treatment and COVID being, from my viewpoint, extremely important and many viewpoints, but they and their mother have no idea about that. They're just sticking with, you know, the vaccination takes care of me. And I love to be able to influence, but it's more like a competition. So I'm looking at how do I or they open. The only thing I can think of so far is don't state your statements, what you think's right. Only ask questions of the other. Just listen and ask questions. And some of those questions can be leading to thought. And then again, I'm not only just interested in how to assist other people to look at other viewpoints and arrive at their own whatever more openly than solidified in their stance, including me, and how to assist people, because I've looked at a lot of friends that have taken your courses and dropped out and would rather avoid the pain of facing their pain or some reason why they don't continue. So that's all my thoughts. Open to you now.
Well, I hear you loud and clear, and, you know, it's kind of sad that people get a positive COVID test and then they're sent home and said, well, you know, wait and see what happens. If you end up in the hospital, well, then we'll treat you, as opposed to gee, you know, you can be empowered and you have an immune system and you can strengthen your natural immunity and that's powerful. And you can, you know, if you get a positive COVID test, there are things you can go home and do today rather than wait and see if it gets worse and you end up in a hospital. Because, you know, by the time people get to the hospital, it's getting pretty late in the game. So definitely I think people need to be looking at early treatment protocols, and before anything shows up in the way of COVID, take care of your immunity. You have an immune system, and the immune system doesn't come from a vaccine. It's something we have, and we definitely need to understand how it works and be our own primary health care providers. That kind of be my take.
We agree, but now how do you influence people? My opinion is not, you know, my projection so far would be that, say, my three children, I've allowed them to develop however they wanted to develop in life and never said anything because I just think they should take their own path. And now they just feel that the back was it, and they send me, from my perspective, not what they're asking me for, which I've given them, statistical information and data from around the world, but they have none. You know, all I got when I asked that was, Dad, I'm hanging up now. So it's like, it seems to me that even me taking a stance that's anything different from where they're at, that alone made them feel wrong. And so they just put out, you know, that I'm wrong. Just simple, non-thoughtful, non-critical thinking, emotionally biased act, you know, instead of critical thinking or true investigation of anything. So then I think, well, how do I just let them go? Or do I just let everybody go and don't try to assist anyone because they've taken their stance? And same with your work. There are certain people that I've loved to encourage to continue or to go into, but I found that one of our good friends has backed up and decided that their problem has strictly been tremendous physical injury, and when they were talking with you, a lot of energy started coming up, and they got very depressed in their voice tones, and they were on the edge of a catharsis, from my opinion, projection, either one. And then they put it away, kind of just backed up and became clear voiced, and but very physically ill. You know, in my opinion, yeah, they have tremendous injury, but they're not wanting to face the emotion as it's more painful for them than physical. I also believe some people put, or me included, it's less painful to have it on a physical level, killing your body with it, than to feel it emotionally when you don't think you have a resolve for it. So those are the, you know, we both agree, yeah, people should have early treatment, but how can we either convince, assist people to look at the possibilities, you know, instead of running away from them in your work, and how can we assist people to look at the possibilities of additional treatment in the first week? That's my goal right now with my kids. How can I present to them that there are many possibilities that they could add to their repertoire, and it's important to do it in the first week if they get any symptoms. Besides,
well,
vitamins, minerals.
You know, one of the things you said earlier is, well, I just decided to let my children take their own path. No child takes their own path. If a parent doesn't raise a child up in a particular way, then somebody or something in the culture is going to. So I'm not a believer in, well, just let them take their own path, because the world has become expert at brainwashing them to go the path that serves the world and commercial interests. So I think we each need to be willing to be that influence in our children's lives. And then, you know, there's an interesting passage in the scriptures where Yeshua was with a large group of disciples, and, you know, they basically ask, well, what do we have to do? And he tells them, you know, there's work to be done. And literally half of his audience, half of his disciples get up and leave and never come back. And their words to him were, too hard a saying. Like, you want me to look inside of me and change and do things? Too hard a saying. And they left. And, you know, that's part of the game, is especially when there's a lot of pain for people. I mean, I've seen people leave, and I've seen it take 10 years to come back and go, what was that you said? Tell me again. And to step into the willingness to do one's own work. Now, I know that for Jeannie and I, you know, we did the codependence intensive back several months ago, and then we did it again. And that's opened a space for our willingness, you know, at the level where we're doing this work, to do a whole new level of work together. So stepping into willingness is a process, and I don't know that there's any pat formula to it, except listening to guidance and being with your intuition to really listen to what each individual needs to hear. I don't think there's a formula to it.
Right. So first, I wish there was. Second, looking at the statement about guidance on my own children, I highly agree with you that I need to get back to it. And they had it when they were young, and because of certain guidance, or because I'm really fortunate, coincidentally, supposedly, they are phenomenally loving and have phenomenal households with tremendous love that I don't see hardly anywhere to that high degree that they have naturally. At the same time, I let go kind of on the concept of they're young men, they want to expand. Once they're 21, 25, somewhere in there, and all three of them made, no, two of them made some big mistakes in their early 20s, which I helped them get through, and then they changed their direction, and just like an oak tree, grew giant and wondrous, and have a great life and all this. But two chose, and I think that was the influence of my good friend Sally, and was there, and just the world and just the crazy concepts that they didn't understand that the church has put forth, or what they experienced with being taken to church by their mother early on. They just, you know, two of them decided to be atheists, maybe all three, I don't know. And Daniel and I had a lot of discussions on quantum field, you know, the idea that...
Down to the last minute, Patrick.
Okay. So let's see. Anyway, I will go, you know, I'm going back to influencing them now. But there's no,
well, I'll hold the space. The right outcome is there for everybody.
Say again? See the bright outcome?
I say I hold the space for the right outcome, safety, and that continuing strengthening of the presence of love in their family systems, in their lives.
Oh, they have that, that's for sure. I think
sweet.
I will see the same wondrous outcome for their opening.
Well, we'll hold the space, my friend. And the show is going to cut us off in a few seconds. So thank you for your input. We hold the space. And everybody, have the best year yet of your eternal lives. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings.
I choose to live more consciously.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.